Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
Actually, on this beautiful Friday, it is going to be David French and myself, Chad Benson, joining you on this beautiful day. They'll be back next week. Old Greg and Jim decided to take some time off. Hope you're doing well on this beautiful day. We've got a bunch of martinis for you, three indeed. And let's start with the good, David. Courts are speaking, and, you know, people are going to have to take a listen to what they're saying, because a lot of times when the court speaks, that is really the, you know, we could talk about the legislative and the executive branch, but the reality is when the court speaks, it's really pretty much done from there.
Well, yeah. Well, let's start with the lower court and then move to the highest court. So the lower court, where things are not done, but at least the conversation gets started. Let's talk about the decision of the Southern District of New York declaring the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, the Elizabeth Warren brainchild, to be unconstitutional in its totality. In other words, that the CFPB is unconstitutionally constituted and that it needs to go away. Now, this is a bold move. It's a bold move from a district court. Now, he's not the final word on this. This does not mean that the CFPB goes away tomorrow, but it does demonstrate that it is on shaky constitutional ground, like crazy conservatives like me and a lot of my National Review colleagues have argued for a long time, that this was an extra constitutional structure that Elizabeth Warren cooked up. And it either has to be fundamentally reformed or go away. And the court here said it's got to go away. And that this is an important moment. And I think I'm going to go ahead and apologize. I believe I misgendered the judge. I said he. It's Loretta Preska, senior United States District Judge. So, but the judge essentially found that the CFPB was unconstitutionally structured, and specifically, you know, one of the big critiques of the CFPB was that it removed too much power in its effort to be independent. It had removed too much power from the president over what was an executive agency. We only have three branches of government in this country. We have an executive run by the president, legislative run by, of course, Congress, which is Congress, and then we have the judicial. And so you got to have, if you're going to have an agency, it's got to fit under typically the executive branch. It's got to be run by a president. It's got to be run according to constitutional structures. And here it is not. And I think the judge is right, but we'll see what happens.
We'll always see what happens, because as we know, there's going to be many more fights along the way. And even with that, the Democrats came out yesterday, and of course, Elizabeth Warren saying that, you know, she's going to fight everything, and it fears in any nominee that will lead this, there's going to be a fight along the way, because of course, it's what they do, and it's what we do when the opposition's in power. We have to fight everything they do. And then we move from there to the court that does have the final say in the land.
Yes.
And they're basically saying, hey, you got a cell phone? Yeah, you're going to need a warrant for that.
Yeah, so this was an interesting decision. This was called Carpenter versus United States, just decided earlier today. And essentially, it's a 5-4 opinion, and it's a proof that sometimes the liberal justices are right. Chief Justice Roberts joined the so-called liberal wing to hold that if you're going to be getting that warrantless seizure and search of historical cell phone records revealing location and movements of a cell phone user over the course of 127 days, you're going to have to get a warrant to get all that kind of historical record, that there's an expectation of privacy that you have in your movements, and that possessing a cell phone does not by itself eliminate that expectation of privacy. It's long opinion. I'm way oversimplifying. I might be oversimplifying to the point of distorting, but the bottom line is, this is a good opinion for civil liberties. When a person purchases a cell phone, which is, let's just be clear, about as close to indispensable in modern life as a item can be. Yeah. The idea that you are then, by purchasing the cell phone, opening yourself up to government tracking, I think is something that should worry Americans. It worries Justice Roberts, and he joined with the liberal justices, reached a good decision, I think, a limited decision, but a good decision. And this is going to be a fight we're going to be fighting for a long time, because as we're more connected and we're more wired, the government's going to have more opportunity to know what we're doing, see what we're doing, to follow what we're doing at any time. And I don't know about you, but I'm not particularly enthused about granting the government that authority.
No, no. You know what? Less authority would be good. That's kind of what I would like, is a little bit less authority. Let me lead my own life kind of thing. They already intrude enough into our lives, whether it be local government, state government, or the federal government. I think less is more in this case. We move from there to the bad side of things with our martini today. Kirsten Nielsen the other day felt the wrath as she was having Mexican food, ironically, and was approached by several people who were quite angry about what's going on down there along the border, blame her specifically for it, and shouted her down doing what they tend to do, which is make a giant scene because it's the best way to apparently get your point across.
Right. So not only does that happen, she's out to eat, somebody finds that, sees her out to eat, texts, apparently the way the story goes, texts some socialist activists who then show up at the restaurant. They start shouting at her, screaming at her while she's trying to eat. She tries to eat for a while. I don't believe that she engaged with the protesters. At least I didn't see it on the videos that I saw. Eventually leaves. There were also protesters right out in front of her house today. There's reports that protesters had shown up at a place where Stephen Miller was eating. There's now people calling for folks to surround and try to shut down the Fox News building. Two things. One, I fully protect and believe in the right of protest, lawful protest. In other words, you know, if you're going to be in a public space where you're permitted to be, you should be able to protest. Totally agree that as a matter of law, so long as you are not trespassing, so long as you are respecting applicable laws, you should have a right to protest in this country, even to do so rudely. But here's the thing. If we're going to start getting in people's faces when they're eating, if we're going to start getting in people's faces when they're walking to and from their houses, if we're going to start getting in people's faces when they're coming to and from work, potentially breaking laws by trespassing, potentially breaking laws by essentially trying to shut people out of their own workplace, this gets dangerous. When you get that up close and personal, when emotions run this high, what I'm very worried about is that this will escalate to violence. Somebody will respond in a way that a protester doesn't like, and a protester will lash out, or a protester will get too close to the personal space of the person they're protesting, and that government official might lash out, or Fox News person might lash out. I mean, this is getting too intense.
You know what, David? We talked a bit about it yesterday, is the rhetoric and the craziness that we see on TV and the debates, that it's very Shakespearean and WWE. And when they're off air, it's nothing like that in real life. The reality is, though, a lot of people out there don't understand that. And the more that you see, especially in a passionate kind of thing where it's not the wonk policy stuff, it's stuff where there's passion and heart. It's more about feelings than facts. That can override. And it only takes one person who is sitting somewhere, who is letting it fester inside, and they decide to act, that turns this thing into what we saw at the baseball practice last year. And we can't have that on either side.
Right, exactly. You know, and a lot of this stuff is being justified by people saying, well, the Trump administration is taking things to a new level, that this is not politics as usual anymore. When the fact of the matter is, there was a large degree of public activism over the last week, and the Trump administration reversed its policy. It reversed course in response to public activism, in response to congressional pressure, in response to media inquiries, in response to public arguments, it reversed course. That looks a lot like actual American politics. Look, people know, listeners who've heard me talk or anyone who's read what I've written knows that I am no fan of Donald Trump. But the idea that Donald Trump is a unprecedented, unique threat to the very existence of American democracy, I think is way over the top, way over the top. And continuing to say this and continuing to say this makes people believe that what they have to do to bring things back into balance is to engage in unprecedented, over the top, dramatic action. And that tends to escalate.
Yes, it does. And that's the scary thing in this day and age, because people, like you said, we're so connected. We can do so many things, and it only takes one crazy to ruin everything. We move from there to the crazy martini, and that is Trump and Obama kind of have something in common when it comes to what's going on down at the border.
Yeah, this is really interesting. And I call it the crazy martini, not because Trump's policy is crazy, but because the rhetoric around Trump's policy is crazy. Let's just back up just a bit. So Trump had implemented a policy of family separation. This policy of family separation is essentially when someone was suspected of coming into the border illegally with minor children, that the Trump administration had a zero tolerance policy where they're going to immediately prosecute people for illegal entry, usually a process that took a very short time. And during that very short prosecution, they would be separated from any minor children they're with. Or if these individuals sought asylum, which they had the rights to do under the law as a defense to, you know, deportation, they were going to remain separated from their children during the course of the asylum proceedings. And the Trump administration said our only option was either to keep them separated from the kids or to release them into the general public because of a rule called Flores, a consent decree that was extended by the Ninth Circuit to prohibit the government from keeping families together, parents and children, for more than 20 days. And so what the Trump administration did in response to public pressure, and I believed this family separation policy was the bad policy, if it was done as a deterrent, in other words, taking kids from moms as a deterrent to entry, I think it goes from worse, it's worse than bad. I think it's a malicious policy, but he changed it. He changed it. And so now what he's trying to do is to detain families together. That is the policy he's trying to accomplish. And now the goalposts have shifted because all the argument was family separation is terrible. Family separation is terrible. Family separation is terrible. And I agreed with that. Family separation is terrible. Then Trump reversed it and says he wants family detention. And now the goalposts have moved. Family detention is terrible. Family detention is awful. Nancy Pelosi called it a form of child abuse. Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi jointly signed a letter that asking the Trump administration to very quickly come up with alternatives to family detention. There are activists who call it a family gulag. Chris Hayes at MSNBC has been saying family detention is a bad policy, and because families aren't a public safety threat, they should be released. And what's missing from most of this conversation is that family detention, right up until 2016, when the Ninth Circuit made him stop, was the Obama policy. Family detention. People would come across the border. There was a wave of families of small kids coming across the border. It created real problems at the border. And so what Obama did was hold parents and kids together at the border. Activists sued to try to stop that, and they eventually won in the Ninth Circuit in 2016. But even as late as 2015, Obama himself was reportedly defending it in person to immigration lawyers as a deterrent to immigration. So here you have the very policy that Pelosi is calling child abuse, that Pelosi and Schumer are directly writing the president to try to reverse, that activists are calling a family a gulag, comparing to a gulag, was the Obama policy. And you know what? Here's why it was the Obama policy. One, because Obama was malicious against immigrants. Nobody thinks that. It's because, you know what? It's a really tough situation at the border. And when you have families streaming into this country illegally, you've got a tough decision on what do you do with them. And family detention prior to deportation or while asylum proceedings are pending is a reasonable response to people coming across the border unlawfully, especially when there are lawful ways to enter the United States. The reason why I'm saying is it's crazy is that there's no sense of proportion or perspective or historical memory in this debate. This isn't child abuse unless you're on the fringe who actually did protest Obama during his second term and did call it child abuse then. It's not actually child abuse. It's a reasonable response to a tough border problem, and it's a response that Barack Obama chose. And for the Democrats to react as if this is something that's just new and unbelievable and horrific, it's just either ignorant or disingenuous.
Well, I'm going to go with a little bit of both at times, to be honest with you. It's, yeah. The reality, David, is it is a little bit of both. And I sit here and I look at this thing, and it has been a nightmare in so many ways. And it doesn't matter because people are only going to hear and believe the things that they want to believe that actually affirms their beliefs. Trump is bad, even if Obama did it. Trump is bad because it's Trump. And morally, he's a bad person. Obama did it with a heart and feeling, and he gave everybody everything they wanted there. Trump is basically treating them as if they're getting ready to head off to the gas chambers. And that's the reality of it, because we're going to believe the things that we want to believe.
Well, yeah. And so what one of the things you're seeing is circulating some of these stories of kids in immigration detention being beaten and abused. And then when you read down in the story, you'll notice, oh, that happened during Obama's second term. A lot of people on the left are really deeply invested in a narrative that goes something like this. The Obama years were a golden time. He was a man of high character within a scandal-free administration who's been being succeeded by a low character person who's incompetent, malicious in his administration, shot through its scandals. So there's a gigantic yawning moral contrast. And then they extend it to say that he defeated not a corrupt person who was the either first or second most disliked American politician in the history of favorability polling in Hillary Clinton, someone who lies habitually and should have been indicted for mishandling the nation's secrets. They say, well, you know, the most qualified person ever to run for president. Look, I think that Barack Obama had a lot in his character to commend him. He seems like a good husband, a good father. I think as a general matter, he was trying to do what he believed was best for the country. But the idea that his administration was scandal-free and that this was some sort of golden age free of scandal is absurd. It's absurd. You had the abuses on the border that happened under his watch. You had the Tea Party targeting that happened under his watch. Fast and Furious, it happened under his watch. You know, there were problems that his administration had without question. It's time for a little bit of humility here. It is not simply the case that this is some sort of black and white dichotomy between good and evil that's existing right now. There were problems in previous administrations, and the Democratic alternative to the Trump administration would be just as scandal-ridden, if not more, than the Trump administration. I mean, when have the Clintons ever been free of scandal? So if there's one thing that's lacking, and I keep saying the last couple of days we've been together, humility and perspective, a sense of proportion. Yeah. It is not the case that you had in 2016 the forces of good of being vanquished by the forces of evil. That was not the dichotomy.
I will say this. Never when you're looking for affirmation in your own, you don't want any proportionality. Nobody will ever search out a way to discredit their beliefs, because that is too open-minded, as you know. And let's throw another olive. Last night was the NBA draft. Were you happy with your picks?
Yes. So I was thrilled. I was thrilled with two things. One, I was thrilled that the Grizzlies didn't make a mistake. That was my number one feeling, because the Grizzlies have made some serious draft errors, Hashim Thabeet, you know, in the recent years. So I was thrilled they didn't make a mistake. I was thrilled they didn't make a bad trade. Their pickups, I think, were exactly in line with the Grizzly tradition of intense defense, people who go to war on the court. So I liked the picks. I liked the bullet dodged of avoiding a bad deal. And hey, it was a fun draft. And, you know, one of my favorite people in the NBA is Mark Cuban, who is just a fun guy to follow in the NBA. He makes the NBA more fun. He made a big move that is going to put his Mavericks back into contention here in the next couple of years. So I'll enjoy watching that. But now all eyes turn to LeBron, man. How is he going to shake up the National Basketball Association? And if he really wants to do it, he goes to Philly. That's my judgment for LeBron. His best move is Philly.
Yep, that's what I think so too. I appreciate you talking today, David. It's always been great. Three Martini Lunch, David French right there. The man, the myth, the legend for the National Review. My name's Chad Benson. Jim and Greg will be back on Monday. Have yourself a great weekend, all, and enjoy your martinis.